I was intrigued by something I read in Civil Engineering Magazine. Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar with Civil Engineering Magazine. You don't usually find it on the newsstand. It's published by the American Society of Civil Engineers, which I'm a member of and have been since I graduated from college. And they have a monthly magazine that brings, it's basically kind of like a news magazine about what's going on in the world of civil engineering. And there was an ad in there for a book, and it intrigued me because they have ads occasionally for books, but this was a little different. The title of the book was The Blessing of Disasters. Now, it was written by a structural engineer, which caught my attention too. His name is Michael Bruno. He's a distinguished professor of the Department of Civil, Structural, and Environmental Engineering at State University of New York. Now, the subtitle of the book is The Lessons That Catastrophes Teach Us and Why Our Future Depends on It, and How Societies Deal with Low Probability, High Consequence Events. So I said, hey, this sounds like a great book. Everybody should read this. So I got the book and read it. And to make a long book short, basically his thesis was that as civil engineers, when anything happens, when a bridge collapses, a dam breaks, whatever kind of a failure happens, civil engineers send experts to say, well, why did it happen? And in studying the why these kind of catastrophes sometimes happen, we learn, and we change our design codes, and we change our design methods. And so we get better and better and safer, but there's no absolute safety. You know, there's always something. And so I'll give you one example of the kind of thing that he was talking about. This is a bridge in Wisconsin. About 16 years ago, it collapsed. It was a twin span. Here's one of the spans. There's the other one. But they were originally identical. This is up near Minneapolis, and this happens to be the Mississippi River right here. Not quite as big as the Mississippi River down here. But this span collapsed. It had been in service for about 30 years. Now, it collapsed about 16 years ago. Now, 13 people were killed, 149 were injured. See this little area right here? Let me blow that up. There were a few lucky people crossing that bridge at the time, as you see some cars sitting there on the edge. So the immediate question was, why did this happen? Now, it's a little bit of an unusual structure. This is a steel arch. And they got steel vertical columns here, and you can't see them, but kind of in between the two sides, there's all kinds of steel coming back and forth. And one of the problems with steel structures is when you have a bunch of steel beams coming together, you have to attach them in some way. And it's hard to kind of weld them in the field. So usually they're attached with a gusset plate. And there was a big flat plate, and each member comes in and bolted in to that gusset plate. And that's the kind of construction. And when they sent in experts to determine why it failed, which is sometimes kind of hard because you can see there's not much left here. But when they removed the debris, they set it aside so engineers could study it. And they concluded that, yeah, one of these joints, one of these gusset plates failed because it was under design. Now, I could go into a lot of detail, but you wouldn't understand much of it. But let me give you a simple explanation of what went wrong and what engineers learned from this. imagine that you have a round cylinder of soft clay. You have the cylinder of soft clay, and you press down on it. It's sitting on a table. You press down on it. Now, what happens is, of course, there's a reaction because it's going to move unless there's an equal and opposite reaction. But if it's a soft clay, it's pretty easy to compress it, And so it moves down vertically, but it also spreads out. Okay, now this is a one-dimensional stress condition, just compression, one direction. But now take the same clay and put it in a tin can and press down on it. Now if you do that, again, you get this compression-type stresses in the clay, but you don't get the bulging because this steel in the steel can prevents that from expanding, which means to get much movement, you have to push it even harder. But what happens is you get resistance. The walls of the tin can that the clay is in is basically pushing back to keep that clay from expanding, and so you're put, and it's uniform all the way around, lateral forces, and so now you have a three-dimensional stress condition. And a three-dimensional stress condition creates some problems. One is the stresses are likely higher than they would be if it was only a one-dimensional. The stresses are higher. But still, the bridge's been there 30 years. Why would it fall down at that time? Matter of fact, at that time, several of the lanes were closed, but they did have some heavy construction equipment on the bridge because they were doing some pavement work. It didn't have anything to do with the collapse, but they did have some heavy equipment, and it was rush hour, so the loads were pretty heavy. But there's something else. And in addition to this stress field that was not really appreciated in the design of the structure, there's something in a characteristic of steel that is called fatigue. Steel gets tired. And I'll show you. I got a little paper clip here. I'll unfold it and just start bending it back and forth like this. And at first, it's kind of hard to bend, but the more I do it, the easier it gets to bend back and forth. And I'm bending it, I'm putting pretty severe stresses on this piece of steel. It's a little small piece of steel, and I'm really bending that thing back and forth. And now it's getting even weaker, and suddenly I've got two pieces of steel here. That's called fatigue. Now, when the stresses are too high in something like a bridge, then it can fatigue and crack and break. And that's basically what happened in this bridge. Now, you got this structure, and down here is a connection, and here's a load of trucks going across the bridge. And when the truck's over here, there's one type of stress distribution. Then by the time the truck gets over here, the stress is reversed. Like I was reversing the stresses as I bent it one way and then bent it the other. That's called fatigue. And steel can handle millions of cycles of fatigue if it's below a certain stress level. But if it gets above that borderline stress level, then its fatigue life is limited. And with this change in stresses from one-dimensional to three-dimensional, increased stresses, the fatigue limit was reached after 30 years. And the bridge collapsed. And so this, what happened was, it took about 2 years to figure all this out after the collapse, but eventually all this information was transmitted to every Department of Transportation, State Department of Transportation in the country, and changes were made in a number of other bridges that had similar kinds of connections. And so probably some lives were saved. Probably more lives were saved from future bridge collapse than died in that particular bridge collapse. So that's the kind of thing that he was talking about. But anyway, in reading this book, maybe that's enough engineering for one day, but in this book, reading it, I said, this is a great idea for a sermon. And so that's the title of my sermon, Why Bridges Collapse. No, The Blessing of Disasters. The Blessing of Disasters. And when I got into this, this is probably a shock to you. It's going to be more than one part to this. Now, let's start with the basics. What is a disaster? Well, you look up dictionary.com or any dictionary, and you'll find basically the same definition. A calamitous event, especially one occurring suddenly, causing great loss of life, damage, or hardship, such as a flood, airplane crash, or business failure, or bridge collapse. So it's a pretty broad definition. We understand disaster, but there are lots of types. Let's list a few of the types. There's the natural disasters, like earthquake, hurricane, tornado, those sorts of things. We've seen a lot of those kind of things happening lately, haven't we? And then there's technological disasters where our technology fails us, such as the several nuclear reactor failures over the last 40 years or so at Chernobyl in the Ukraine and at Fukushima in Japan. But buildings, airplanes crashes, the bridges, those kind of things are usually technological failures. And then there's terrorist attacks. That's man-made disasters. And doomsday scenarios, thinking about anticipating disasters to come, as I was talking about in my previous sermons about the end of the age and Christ's return. That's kind of a doomsday type of scenario when Christ returns. But then there's the personal ones, loss of a loved one, and particularly untimely death from disease, a crippling traffic accident, or heart attack, these sorts of things. Then there's one more that deserves mention, and that's the disaster in which you're oblivious that has happened. The oblivious disaster is so slowly unfolding that they're not seen or not realized until it's kind of too late. And I'll give you an example of that, because we're in the midst of one of these disasters, which I think most people basically are oblivious to, and to the extent of it. And it has to do with abortions. I ran across this graph. I know the print may be a little small for you to see, but the main things I wanted you to see in this is the number of legal abortions in the United States since 1973, when abortions became legal, when the Supreme Court ruled on Roe versus Wade, and it goes up to 2020, so it's a couple years behind here. But there's two curves here. One, this solid blue curve, is the Guttmacher Institute curve, and then this lighter one is CDC's curve. And the Guttmacher one's considered more accurate because CDC requests information from hospitals and major clinics, but not the small abortion clinics and some of those types of things. The Guttmacher Institute, they went to every place that performed abortions to get their numbers. So it's considered more accurate. Plus, you notice there's a big gap right here. Well, California and several other states stopped giving that information to CDC. And there's a few smaller gaps here, so a couple of other smaller states joined in. But this is viewed as the larger one. And you can see that there was a plateau here for a number of years, basically the 80s, where there was over 1.5 million abortions pretty much every year. And then it's been declining quite a bit. And you can see now it's got a little uptick here, but down to in the vicinity of a million now, at least according to the Guttmacher Institute, about 2/3 of a million if you're using the CDC data. So you see numbers like that, and they're just numbers. But think about it. Let's use this last number here, this 930,160 per year. How much is that per day? If you divide by 365, you come up with 2,548 per day. Compare that to the 1,400 that were killed on October 7th over in Israel. Or the 2,400 at 9/11 that were killed when those buildings collapsed. 2,548 per day in the United States. Now that comes out to be 106 per hour, or a little less than 2 per minute on a 24-hour basis. You know, when you look at these numbers that way, you can't help but ask the question, how long is God going to put up with a country that does this and doesn't even seem to think about it as being a disaster? Now, some of these unborn babies would have not made it to term, or at least when they were born, they'd probably died very quickly because of deformities and whatever. But the vast majority of these unborn babies would have survived, and they're gone. So there are all kinds of disasters. Some people just don't seem to see and will not see until it's too late. And let's put this in a little different perspective here. This is for 2021, so it's a year later, so it's not a direct comparison, but these numbers don't change much from year to year, with the exception of COVID. And this is showing the number of deaths by cause. I know that's a little small there. You might not be able to read it. But heart disease up at the top, cancer, the two big ones, COVID. This was in 2021 when we were still getting a lot of COVID deaths. But then unintentional accidents and so forth, stroke, the respiratory diseases and so forth, Alzheimer's, diabetes, kidney and liver failures, these last two. And you can see they're all declining, basically, you know, heart and cancer are the two big ones. But let's put the CDC death toll per year up here and see how it ranks with all the other causes of death. And then the Guttmacher Institutes, way out here compared to any other cause of death. Now, you've been hearing a lot about fentanyl lately, the last few years, fentanyl deaths. I looked that up and put the fentanyl deaths up for 2021, right down here at the bottom. Pretty small compared to abortion deaths. Yeah, so this is the kind of thing that's going to sneak up on people, these oblivious disasters that you don't see coming. All right, but let's get on here. Who decides if something is a disaster? I'm going to ask a few questions here during the course of this sermon. Who decides if something is a disaster? Well, it's kind of an individual opinion of whether something's a disaster or not. But, you know, I think most of us say, well, if somebody dies, at least personally, that's a disaster. But that's not quite true. My father died when I was 18. He was in his early 50s. And to me, that was a disaster. But my mother died when she was in her late 80s. She had been very ill for some time. She had dementia. And while it was sad, it was kind of a relief. She had lived a full life, and she was suffering. And so I don't consider that a personal disaster like I did my father die at a much younger age, suddenly like that. And we see that in the Bible too. Look at a couple of people. How about Moses? Was it a disaster when Israel lost Moses? Well, he was 120 years old at the time. He'd lived a full life. In Deuteronomy 34, verses 4 and 5, then the Lord said to him, this is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of God. Now, surely it was a loss, but was it really a disaster at that time? You know, why did he not get at least go into the promised land? And I won't show the scripture, but in Numbers 20:12, this is explained, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel. You know, when you've given a lot and you're capable of doing a lot, then a lot is expected. How about Paul? 2 Timothy 4, verses 6 through 8. What he says when he's facing death, for I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I've fought the good fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. There is a time to live and a time to die, as Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 and 2. So, yes, personal deaths are sad, but there's some are disastrous. Some are really, it's just the end of a long and quite often a well-lived life. Let's take another example here. Is this a disaster? You know what it is? Yeah, it happened 60 years ago in a couple of weeks. No, not 60, 80 years ago in a couple of weeks. 82 years to be exact in a couple of weeks, Pearl Harbor. I was about 3 weeks old at the time, and I remember it vividly. Now, I dare say no one in this room was old enough, if you were even alive, to remember anything about the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Maybe there are a few out there listening in that were old enough for to have some memories of what the times were like when that happened. Here's another view of a Japanese Zero honing in on some already damaged ships. let me ask you some questions here. Put yourself, you're an adult living on December 7th, 1941. Okay, a couple of cases here. First, you're an adult American at that time. Would you say this was a disaster? Probably most everyone would. Okay, now, I'm taking your American citizenship away. You're no longer an American. You are Japanese living in Tokyo on December 7th, 1941. Would you then say, as a Japanese, that this was a disaster or a glorious victory? Okay, now let me move you again. You're still a Japanese, but now you're a Japanese today in Tokyo. What would you think about the bombing of Pearl Harbor as a Japanese looking back in history? Would you still call it a great victory? Or would you see it as almost the beginning of what led to almost the total destruction of Japan? A disaster. One more, you're now an American, present day, and you have a little knowledge of history. And looking back on it, would you not maybe think, as some historians do, that, well, if the Japanese hadn't bombed Pearl Harbor and we had stayed out of the war for another year or so, it may have been too late. This may not have been a disaster, but saving the country, the world. You know, so disasters can have different meanings to different people at different times. By the way, the number of deaths at Pearl Harbor, 2,400. 2 days worth of abortions. All right, so what was the first human disaster? I think most of us could probably agree that it occurred in the Garden of Eden. Genesis 3, verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and the tree desirable to make one wise, she took of it the fruit and ate, and she also gave it to her husband with her, and he ate. Boy, did that start some things. So you certainly could look at it that way. But was it an earlier disaster? Yeah, there was. It just didn't involve humans. Ezekiel 28, verses 12 through 15, is described by the prophet Ezekiel. Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre. Say to him, thus says the Lord God, you are the seal of protection, perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes were prepared for you. On the day that you were created, you were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day that you were created till iniquity was found in you. And then looking at Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 15, it says a little bit more about this. Verse 12, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the further sides of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol and to the lowest depths of the pit. A galactic war is what this sounds like. As God, as Satan tried to overthrow God. Which brings us to Genesis 1, verses 1 and 2, and the gap theory. You know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. And the theory is that there's a big gap between this statement and verse 2, the earth was without form and void. That word was is hayak in Hebrew, which can also be translated became. The earth became without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of the God was hovering over the face of the waters. So it was created, but all of a sudden it was a mess. Now, you know, we go what science tells us about the Big Bang. You've seen this before. I've shown it to you. Mr. Campos showed it in his recent Life, Hope, and Truth presentation. The Big Bang theory started here. All kinds of funny things happened initially. There was this expansion that doesn't fit anything we know about science. But then this continued expansion of the universe, and we are here 13.7 million years later, at least according to the scientists. But you know what's missing here? Was any evidence of, or taking into account, any evidence of a galactic war going on? So this could be way off, because we don't know what happened when Satan declared war on God. But it does appear that if the gap theory is true, that the earth was a mess. And so the question becomes, why didn't God design a safer planet? Why not? Do we really need earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes? Do we really need all this stuff? Why didn't he design a planet with none of that stuff? What's the matter with God anyway? Well, I'm speculating here, but maybe he did. Maybe he did. Because look what it says in Genesis 1. I'm going to read a few verses here about the creation. Verse 3, God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light, and that it was good. That it was good. He didn't say, well, it's okay, but you're going to have some droughts because of this light. He didn't say, yeah, it's okay, but you might get sunburned. He just said it was good. Verse 10, he called the dry land earth, and gathered together waters and called them seas, and said it was good. Yeah, but what about tsunamis? That doesn't sound so good. What about earthquakes on dry land? That doesn't sound good. What is God's definition of good here? Doesn't seem to be the thing that we're living on right now, this earth. Verse 12, and the earth brought forth grass and the herb that yielded its seed according to its kind, and the trees that yield fruit whose seed is in itself according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. Everything seemed very good. And we could go on here. Sun and the moon. God saw that it was good. And then he created the sea creatures and the birds, and they were good. And then he made all the animals on dry land, the things that crawl and creep on the earth, and that was good. Maybe God never thought about being bitten by an alligator. Or getting poison ivy. That doesn't sound so good. But then look what he said in verse 31. Then God saw that everything he had made, and indeed it was very good. It wasn't just good. It was very good. Is that the earth we're living in today? Is it very good? Look at Genesis 2. The Lord planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And verse 9, out of the ground, the Lord made every tree grow that is pleasant in sight and good for food. How about the bad trees? Just sounds like he made the good trees. In verse 19, out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would name them. So Adam said, okay, I'm calling this one a goat. I'm calling this one a sheep. And then he pointed to the other one, and the lion ate him. End of creation story. So what happened? Were all the animals tamed then? Or did Adam probably pretty healthy muscle guy, did he climb a tree right quick? Only to find a panther sitting up there? Oh, that's the panther. Yeah, what's going on here? You know, there seems to be this very good versus what we see now. Well, something did change. And as a result of that, we come down to Genesis 3. And after the forbidden fruit episode, God has some things to say to first to Eve in verse 16 of Genesis 3. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Okay. here's my questions, well, several questions about this. Does this mean that before that sin, there was no pain in giving birth? Now, why would he say there's going to be pain now if there was also pain before? Why did he say that? Now, it seems to be suggesting here he changed the nature of women. And then he says, you know, your husband will rule over you, and you shall desire for your husband. You know, it sounds like something changed in women. Like maybe they're kind of on an equal partnership basis and say, oh, it's not going to work that way anymore. You know, I don't know. I'm only speculating here, but just reading what this says seems to apply. Something really big happened. And then he talks to Adam. And he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. So now he's cursed the ground. How did he curse it? Did he suddenly create fault lines? Did he suddenly create funnels from deep in the earth up, forming volcanoes? How did he curse the earth? I don't have the answer, but you have to ask that question, don't you? But continuing on here in verse 18, both thorns and thistles shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return again. Was there a perfect world then in terms of how things grow and so forth? Just throw the seeds out and it grows and you just kind of pick it. What's going on here? Did God change the makeup of dirt? Did he create thorns and thistles at this point, after the original creation was over? Is this when he created mosquitoes and other annoying little pests? All right, which brings me to a bigger question here. Is God responsible for all disasters? Can we blame it on God? I might mention here that the term disaster is not actually used in the King James Bible, only in the New King James. For example, in Acts 27, verses 9 and 10, now when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, men, I perceive that this voyage will end in disaster and much loss. Now, if we look at the King James Version, there in verse 10, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage. Well, that pretty much sounds like a disaster, but you see the phrases were different. Disaster is used, not a whole lot, but it's used throughout the Old and New Testament, like in the Old Testament. So David said to in 2 Samuel 15, verse 14, so David said to all his servants who were with him in Jerusalem, arise, let us flee, and we shall not escape Absalom. This is when Absalom tried to take over the crown. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us. Now, if we look at the King James Version, it says, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us. Yeah, it's the same words. But, I mean, it's the same thought. But they just didn't use the word disaster back then. And, you know, disasters do affect both the obedient and the disobedient. How about Elijah? In James 5, verse 17, James is writing about Elijah and says, Elijah was a man with a nature like our own. And he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. So it didn't rain on the just or the unjust during that period of time. So did Elijah bring on this disaster? No, God brought the disaster on. Elijah told him to pray for it. But God brought it on. God was responsible for this disaster. And it was a disaster that affected some righteous people. Most of them weren't, but some were. Now, look at Deuteronomy 32, verses 23-24. This is from called the Song of Moses in most Bibles. But it's Moses kind of just giving a farewell to all the Israelites before they went into Canaan and he died. And he's quoting God here and saying, I will heap disasters on them. I will send my arrows on them. They shall be wasted with hunger, devoured by pestilence and bitter destruction. I will also send against them the teeth of beasts with the poison of serpents of the dust. Now, the condition was, if you don't obey me, I will bring these disasters down on you. So God causes a lot of disasters. Now, look at 2 Chronicles 20, verses 7 through 9. Are you not our God who drove, and this is a prayer of Jehoshaphat when he was surrounded by Moab and Ammon and various other armies that were surrounding him. He turned to God and prayed and said, are you not our God who drove out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel? You gave it to the descendants of Abraham, your friend, forever. And they dwell in it and have built you a sanctuary in it for your name, saying, if this disaster comes upon us, sword, judgment, pestilence, or famine, and that's a good definition of disaster, we will stand before this temple and in your presence, for your name is in the temple, and cry out to you in our afflictions, and you will hear and save. Okay, so this is a disaster. Jehoshaphat reckoned, hey, God's bringing this disaster on. And what was the result? In verse 17, you will not need to fight in this battle. Position yourselves, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord. Now, so they were saved at that time. They were saved from disaster. But you have to say, God was pretty much responsible for those disasters. He brought it on them. It's not that they didn't deserve it. They didn't disobey God. But still, he created everything. He created us, them. And you kind of have to say, God's kind of responsible for pretty much all disasters. Not that he hasn't given us warnings about how to avoid them. Romans 8, verses 18 through 21. Look how Paul wrote about this topic. He's really talking about disasters here. He says, for I consider the sufferings of this present time, are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly awaits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subject to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. What he's saying. Hey, since God created everything, he's the one that's responsible for these disasters, and we better learn from them. It's kind of like He's thrown us into the fire. Say, learn how to not get burned. Then he continues on in Romans 8, down in verse 35 through 39. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword or disasters? What's going to separate us from God? Are disasters going to do it? Because he says, you're going to see them. As it is written, for your sake we are killed all day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. We're counted for sleep, sheep for the slaughter. Is that what we are? Verse 37, yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor power, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Now he quoted Psalm 44 here. He said, boy, you're going to get slammed with a lot of disasters. Deal with it. But in verse Psalm 44, let's look at that passage where he quoted here. Psalm 44, verses 20 through 26. We have forgotten the name of our God or stretched out our hands to a foreign God. Would not God search us this out? For he knows the secrets of the heart. And here's the quote that Paul used. Yet for your sake we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. You know, here David's saying, hey, have you forgotten us? Why do you hide your face and forget our affliction and our oppressions? For our soul is bowed down to the dust and our bodies cling to the ground. Arise for our help and redeem us for your mercy's sake. David knew disasters. And that was his prayer. This is getting kind of rough, God. Can we kind of ease off a little bit on the disaster thing here? Then back to Deuteronomy 11, verses 16 and 17. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. Yeah, pretty much God's saying, I've put you in a pretty tough place. And yeah, there's going to be some pretty hard times to deal with. I want to see what you're made of. I want to see what kind of faith you really have. Look at number 16, verses 28 through 32. And Moses said, now this is Korah's rebellion. Look at how Moses laid it on the line. And Moses said, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works. For if I have not done them of my own will, if these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by the common faith of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. You got this group of rebellious people and the rest of the tribes and saying, okay, I'll show you how it works. If they just live through their lives, don't believe me. But, in verse 30, if the Lord creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord. And boy, did that happen. You know, when something like that happens, that gets your attention. Now, the weather seems to be one thing that God likes to use. You know, as one of his favorite causes of disasters, is various weather conditions. And then also, earthquakes, volcanoes, the works. And what happened in verse 32? And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their household and all the men with Korah and with all their goods. Apparently, women and children were all swallowed up. So, wow, how can a loving God allow all these disasters? What's going on here? Well, this is a question that people who don't believe in God ask and answer. They say things like this: there's no God, because God allows pain, suffering, disease, and natural disasters. How can that be a God? Or two, because evil exists. Why would God allow evil to exist? Well, there's no scientific proof. Oh, yeah, there's this Big Bang. There's some evidence and so forth. But proof means God comes down, stares me in the eye, and says, I'm God, you're nothing, and does some miracles to prove it. Then I would believe in God. As a matter of fact, one famous atheist pretty much said just that. That's what it would take to convince him. I wonder if God will do it that way when he faces God. But anyway, it's illogical. What? We're physical human beings. What's all this God stuff? Injustice. How can God allow all this injustice? And then there's the, I don't need God because I'm doing pretty well. I'm getting along okay. Matter of fact, life is probably better without God. Now, as shocking as it seems to me, I know some people that pretty much said that back in 1995, in the end of Worldwide Church of God. People left and basically pretty much said, I don't need it. I don't need a religion. Oh, there's probably a God, but, you know, he's somewhere and I'm here. And I'm doing all right. And some have even said, told me, you know, I'm happier now that I'm not in that church kind of thing. Mm. Well, God made a choice to give us a choice. Now, he could have done it that way. Every time you had a slightly evil thought, you'd feel something come out and slapping you inside the head. Boy, I better get that thought out of my mind. Now, he could have done it that way. But what would we have learned from that? But he made a choice on giving us a choice. Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, I call on heaven and earth as witness today against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing, therefore choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. Choose life, your choice. You see it. You see the good, you see the evil, what are you going to choose? Because it's not only going to affect you, it's going to affect your descendants. They are going to pay the price as well as you if you make the wrong choice. Hebrews 5, verse 9. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. He holds out a great promise, but you have to make the choice. He's not going to make it for you. Matter of fact, he's going to kind of make it hard for you sometimes to make that choice, to see what you're made of. Men, like we said already in Ecclesiastes 1, 2, verse 2, there is a time to be born and a time to die. Every single person that has ever lived had to deal with death. Well, except for us who are still alive. But we will. We'll have to deal with that too. Now, that's the constant. Life, physical life, means death at some point. And God not only gave us the ability to choose, but also the promise. Proverbs 3, verses 1 and 2. My son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. For the length of days and long life and peace they will give to you. So here we see that there is some connection between living a long life and your attitude towards obeying God. the fifth commandment, Exodus 20:12. Honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Ecclesiastes 9:11-12. Solomon observed, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, the battle is not to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. Don't we see that all the time? How did that guy make so much money? He's not that smart. He's not that good. He inherited it from his father. How does he get to do that? You know, it's the way it works, doesn't it? But time and chance happen to them all. Time and chance is there. For man also does not know his time, like fish taken up in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. We live in a very dangerous world. All mankind has lived in a very dangerous world since Adam and Eve. Isaiah 9:6-7. You'll hear this verse 6 a lot in the next month and a half. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. You hear that verse a lot, like I say, coming up in the next month and a half. How often do you hear verse 7? Of the increase in his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform it. You think people read that and say, wow, a Jew is going to be king over the whole earth. Jesus was a Jew. People don't think, do they? They don't really think, but there's a big picture. God has opened our minds to seeing the big picture. We understand that man's government, whatever it is, simply will not work. So, some wag concluded that all governments can be defined by the two-cow metaphor. You ever heard the two-cow metaphor for all governments? Oh, I'll give you some. Feudalism, government back in the Middle Ages. You have two cows. Your lord takes some of the milk. Or how about socialism? You have two cows. The government takes one and gives it to your neighbor. Or how about communism? You have two cows. You give them to the government, and the government gives you some milk. Or how about fascism? You have two cows, you give them to the government, and the government sells you some milk. A militarism, you have two cows, the government takes both and drafts you. Bureaucracy, you have two cows. At first, the government regulates what you can feed them and when you can milk them. Then it pays you not to milk them, and after that it takes both, shoots one, milks the other, and pours the milk down the drain. Then it requires you to fill out forms accounting for the missing cows. How about American democracy? The government promises to give you two cows if you'll vote for it. After the election, the president is impeached for speculating in cow futures. The press dubs the affair Cowgate. A Russian capitalism. you have two cows. You drink some vodka and count again, and you have five cows. The Russian mafia shows up and takes however many cows you actually have. Or Chinese capitalism. You have two cows. You have 300 people milking them. The government claims that you have full employment and high bovine productivity. They arrest and make disappear the news reporter who suggested this might not be true. And then there's Japanese capitalism. You have two cows. You redesign them so that they are one-tenth the size of an ordinary cow and produce 20 times the milk and market it worldwide. And then there's totalitarianism. You have two cows. The government takes both and shoots you. Then capitalism, you have two cows. You sell one and buy a bull, then you put both in your wife's name and declare bankruptcy. And then there's political correctness. You are associated with two differently aged bovines of non-specified gender. And then I'll give you one last one. The kingdom of God. You have two cows. The government gives you rain in due season, land so fruitful that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and soon you have 10 cows. You take one and give it to the government and sell two and use the money from one to give offerings to the government and from the other to celebrate the government's holy days. Soon you have 20 cows. So until that time, we have to learn to embrace the challenges of disasters. More on this next time.